We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. One might argue that there are at least two key traditions at the core of America's founding. On the one hand, we have the Enlightenment principles of reason and science and the free pursuit of truth. As Thomas Jefferson wrote, "Truth is great and will prevail if left to herself. Truth is the proper and sufficient antagonist to error, and truth has nothing to fear unless disarmed of her natural weapons, free argument and debate." So that's one of the traditions. But the other key tradition, of course, is religion. God, the Creator, and the divine are mentioned three times in the Declaration of Independence. So how do we start thinking about the tension between reason and religion at the nation's founding? Well, during our discussion today, we will attempt to answer some key questions at the core of America. Namely, how did Thomas Jefferson and the other founders think about religion? What did they think was the appropriate role of religion in American society? And how should we think about the connections between reason and religion at the nation's founding and even today? I'm very happy to have an expert in religion and colonial history to help us think through these enormous questions, Thomas S. Kidd. Welcome, Tommy.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Kidd serves as research professor of church history at Midwestern Baptist Seminary in Kansas City, Missouri. He is also a research scholar at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion. Dr. Kidd has authored numerous books, including Thomas Jefferson, A Biography of Spirit and Flesh, published by Yale University Press in 2022. So, Tommy, you read that famous passage from the Declaration. How are we to begin to understand that phrase, that we are endowed by our Creator, with certain unalienable rights?
Well, the founding fathers in America were not in agreement about lots of issues about religion and theology, but one principle that I think they were in very broad agreement about was that somehow or other that human beings are created by God. It may not be in the way that is described exactly in the Bible. There may be doubts among one founder or another about what the book of Genesis says about Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. But they are certainly, all of them, living in a mental universe that assumes that people are created, and that people didn't just come from nothing, they didn't evolve over millions of years into current form, and this is a pre-Darwinian intellectual world. And so even for someone like Jefferson, who goes through phases in his life when he is extremely skeptical about basic ideas about Christianity, he is still a theist and believes in a created order. And so if you ask someone like Jefferson where people came from and where they got their rights, he would assume, like virtually everyone involved in the founding, that people are created and that we get our rights from the way that God made us, and that, as the Declaration says, that God endowed us with our basic rights, including life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And so there is a theological, theistic foundation to the principles articulated in the Declaration that unites the founding, even though you have a very broad range of belief among the founders. You have people like Jefferson and Franklin who are skeptics, and Franklin calls himself a deist, to more traditional Christian believers People like Patrick Henry or John Jay, who's one of the authors of The Federalist and the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who are more traditional Christians. So there's a pretty wide range about personal beliefs about Christianity, but more of a foundational belief in a created order.
Yeah, and I'm just going to break in right now. I hear these words theism and deism used quite a bit. Can you just help our audience understand what that meant?
Yeah, I mean, theism is maybe not a word that's used that often among the founders, but it's basically a belief in one God who ordinarily would be the creator God. Deism is used a lot at the time of the founding, but there is not a unitary definition of what the word means. Sometimes it just means that you have doubts about certain traditional Christian doctrines, especially Calvinist doctrines. And so for somebody like Franklin, who grows up in a traditional Calvinist family in Boston, his deism is very much a reaction against the faith of his parents. And sometimes people talk about deism as a belief in a sort of cosmic watchmaker or creator God, but a God that is not necessarily involved in human affairs today, that God has created the universe, but now is off doing maybe something else and has kind of left the world alone. In Franklin's case, he still, especially in his older years, believes in God's providential role in history, but he definitely doesn't believe in a traditional Christian doctrines like Jesus as the Son of God or Jesus's divinity or Jesus's resurrection. So deism usually entails not believing in certain core Christian doctrines.
So when we think of deism, would it be fair to say that this was some attempt back then for people who were very much taken by Enlightenment values to find some way of meshing some concept of a higher power that created the universe? Without being considered to be atheist, if atheism was even a thing back then.
Right. I mean, atheism in our form of that term is not really an intellectual option in 1776 in America. It's starting to come online in France. And France is the most aggressively skeptical Enlightenment national tradition. But in America and in places like England and Scotland, you have more of a Christian-friendly kind of version of the Enlightenment. And so, you know, people like Jefferson and Franklin, who are the most obviously skeptical among the major founders, along with Thomas Paine, are assuming still that there is a created order and that there's a created God, but they don't believe in a lot of the traditional basic Christian doctrines. So that's why I say they are theistic in a sense of believing in a creator God, but they don't believe in necessarily the authority of the Bible. They don't believe in claims about Jesus being the Son of God and having risen from the dead. And so they're looking for an option where there's still a created order and there are moral precepts derived from the Jewish and Christian traditions, you know, love your neighbor as yourself and those kind of things. But when you get into the specifics of Christian doctrine, they tend to be skeptical about most of the supernatural claims, in particular about Jesus.
So a deist who is believing in a hands-off creator would not then believe in Christian miracles. Would that be correct?
Right. And I mean, somebody like Franklin may even believe that it's possible for God to intervene in human history, but he doesn't believe in the supernatural claims about Jesus in particular. So, you know, deism, I find, it's classically defined as an uninvolved, like non-providential God, a belief in a non-providential God, but a God who is the creator nevertheless. But I think that Franklin and even at times Jefferson speak in a way that they suggest that they do believe in a providential role for God. So I would say that deism doesn't even necessarily mean a rejection of a providential role for God.
You've been using this word providential rule for God, and indeed when we get to the last sentence of the Declaration of Independence, we hear the words divine providence. So I'm just going to read that out, and maybe you can expand on that concept a little bit more. So, audience, this is the very last sentence. And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. It's such a curious passage, I find. With a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence. How do you read that?
I think that they're saying that they're taking on a cause that is fraught with danger to the patriots, and that if they are taking on, I mean, they've already been at war with Britain for about 15 months by this point when they issued the declaration. And it would have been very widely assumed that you can't win a war without God's providential aid, because you can have as strong an army as you like, but that God can still send storms to, you know, say, to foil the Spanish Armada, like in 1588, or, you know, can just cause even weaker armies to win battles. And so that they're saying that we trust that because our intentions are right, as they say a little earlier in the declaration, and that our cause is just, that we can trust that providence, and providence is basically synonymous for an active God in history, that providence will protect us in this cause. And I think that they believe that. I think they were saying it because they believe that God would protect them, but they're also saying it as a way to, you know, tip the cap, as it were, to God, and saying we haven't forgotten about you. They did need to add some of that theistic language in the last paragraph, because Jefferson's draft had sort of brought up God early on, but then kind of gotten into more technical matters for the rest of the declaration. So Congress is saying we want to begin and end by recognizing God's authority and power over what we're doing. And that if our cause is not just, we certainly don't have any reason to think that God will protect us in this war.
So a deist like Franklin would have not found that passage problematic, the assumption that the divine would somehow guarantee the success of the patriots.
I think that Franklin in particular is of two minds about this. I think earlier in his life, he certainly said things and wrote things that would have mocked the idea of God's providential role in war. I mean, in some of the wars between the British colonies in America and French Canada, he talked about, how does this work? I mean, do you have to have, you know, more prayers to God on one side, the same Christian God on one side? And, you know, so if you have 150 prayers on one side and 149 on the other side, that God will act providentially. So he is known to make fun of this kind of providentialism. But I think as Franklin gets older and he starts to feel more the weight of leadership, he at least is not given as much to making fun of that kind of idea. I mean, I think Franklin at least moves into a mode of, well, this can't hurt. And he even at the Constitutional Convention, 11 years after the Declaration of Independence, he even proposes that delegates open sessions with prayer, a motion that did not pass, by the way, amazingly. But it's ironic by that point that Franklin, who is in his 80s by that point, has decided that it's a good idea to open the Constitutional Convention with prayers to God for his blessing and guidance on their proceedings. So I think as Franklin gets older, he at least becomes more comfortable with the idea that it doesn't hurt anything to pray for and ask for God's providential protection.
And we've been now thinking about God's providential protection. Someone like Franklin would not have assumed this was a Christian God, presumably, but it would be a God. Whereas,
right. As
the theists would have believed that divine providence would have been the Christian God.
Right. I mean, and it's a little difficult with people like Franklin and Jefferson to sort out the difference between those two, because Franklin especially, but also Jefferson grow up in deeply Christian contexts. So the all of their theological understanding is shaped by Christian categories. And they're around all, at least nominally, professing Christians. But I think Franklin in particular thought that all, at least monotheistic religions that teach a creator God are basically referring to the same God, whether it's Judaism or Islam or another kind of religion, that we're all talking about the creator God, and there is one creator God, but we assign different, you know, specific doctrines to him. But I think Franklin in particular has very much of a kind of comparative religions type of view of the creator God, and would not insist that the Christian God is the only true God.
So we've discussed the divine providence line, we've discussed the creator line, and we're going to move on to discuss other things. But the third passage in the Declaration, which is actually the verse that appears, we're doing this in an incorrect order, is from the very beginning, where we have the mention of laws of nature and of nature's God. And I'll just read this passage again, and I'll have you gloss it for me, please. So this is the famous opening. When, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them. A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. Again, I think that's such a fascinating short phrase that encapsulates what we've been discussing already, which is we have the laws of nature, and here we hear the resonances of the Enlightenment, the laws of nature. We have science there. The Ben Franklin, I imagine Ben Franklin with his kite calling down lightning. And then, of course, but we have nature's God immediately after that. And those are those two traditions, those two perspectives in the same small passage. How do you look at those lines there?
I think they're drawing on Lockean theory from the English political philosopher John Locke about the idea that there is a state of nature in which God originally put people, and that people then subsequently created government, but that government doesn't change people's sort of separate and equal station. In other words, that people are created naturally independent and equal, and that it is government corruption that often makes people unequal and, in the worst cases, oppressed. And so that there is a natural right in the order of creation for people in extreme circumstances to return to that natural original state in which God put them. So you can make that argument in a kind of John Locke, Jeffersonian, Franklin type of sense without reference to the Bible, though, I mean, some of this echoes what is described in the opening chapters of the book of Genesis, of people's original state of having been created by God. But again, the emphasis here is on the created order and the natural created state in which we originated. And so when government becomes tyrannical, Locke is proposing, you know, in the context of the 1680s and 90s in England, when government becomes tyrannical, people have a natural right because of the, you know, the nature of creation to return to their kind of original state of being in a state of equality and being, you know, even separate from the government under which they find themselves if that government becomes tyrannical. So I think it is an Enlightenment statement, but it's also theistic. You know, often with, except for, you know, some of the French philosophers who go in a more atheistic direction with this, you do find those complementary relationships between kind of reason coming out of the Enlightenment and theistic assumptions. Now, again, this is not specifically Christian. It's more generically theistic, but that doesn't make it any less important in a philosophical sense that they assume that there is a natural state into which people were created by God and that God has put natural laws in place that sort of define what justice is, what good government is, and that people should make recourse to that, especially when faced with the prospect of government tyranny.
And one form of that tyranny would be the government choosing which religious beliefs are correct and which are incorrect and which religious ideas are authorized and which are not. And maybe we can use this then to kind of talk about the different constellations of religious groupings in the colonies. I know there were Baptists who got who were maybe not as popular as some others. We're actually recording this 2 days after the death of Pope Francis, and I'm also going to ask you, what was it like to be a Catholic at the time? Because, of course, Britain being a Protestant Anglican country, its great enemy were the Catholic French and Spain, also implicated in the Seven Years' War beforehand. So do you just want to talk a little bit about the major groupings of religious or Christian, mostly Christian belief at the time?
Sure. Well, among white colonists, the religious commitment is overwhelmingly Christian, though obviously, you know, any given person may be more or less committed to a God and the church in their weekly lives. Small numbers of Jews, especially in places like Newport, Rhode Island, and Charleston, South Carolina.
And audience, we will be doing a episode on Jews in the colonies coming up shortly, so stay tuned.
Right. So among the Christians, they're overwhelmingly Protestant, with small numbers of Catholics, again, centered in places like Maryland, which was originally a Catholic colony. And then you have Quebec and Canada, which at the time of the Revolution was also a British colony, but Quebec is majority Catholic. And so among Protestants, you do have, in most of the colonies, you have an official state church, an established church. And in the New England colonies, except for Rhode Island, the established church was the Congregationalist Church, which is the old church of the Puritans. And everywhere else that has an established church is the Church of England or the Anglican Church. So the Congregationalist Church and the Anglican Church then have special legal advantages in those colonies where it's established, but you have a variety of other Protestant groups, Presbyterians, as you said, Baptists, who were often some of the most persecuted groups. The Baptists were, and Catholics were not in good standing legally in most of the colonies and suffered under a variety of disadvantages. Other smaller groups, Dutch Reformed, the Quakers, Mennonites, Lutherans, and down to, you know, very small groups. And so there really wasn't religious freedom in most of the colonies in the form we would recognize it. The places where you get closest to having a modern version of religious freedom is in Rhode Island and Pennsylvania, because those colonies, for a variety of reasons, don't have any kind of official state church at all. though in Pennsylvania, you definitely have a dominant role, at least informally, for the Quakers.
And you talked about some of the, I can't remember the phrase you used, they didn't have the same advantages, legal advantages, or they were disadvantaged in some way. Are we talking about like taxation or let me just say, when you use the word persecution, to what extreme levels of persecution are we talking about?
Well, Baptists in particular were very aggressive evangelistically and proselytizing for new converts, and they were seen as a sort of a bizarre group because they were really the only Christian group outside of the Quakers that didn't practice infant baptism. Protestants, obviously Catholics, virtually all Christian groups practiced infant baptism at the time. But Baptists, as you can tell from their name, had a different view. They believed that you should only baptize people who had experienced Christian conversion at an age old enough to understand what was happening to them. And so they practiced what was called believer's baptism. And so they were seen as an oddball group, but also they were very aggressive in terms of wanting to preach wherever they wanted to, whether it's on, the town green or, the courthouse square. And they would start churches without getting the government's permission to do so. And that was illegal in many of the colonies. They were required to get a license to preach, and the Baptists wouldn't do that. So they had all kinds of, Baptists and other groups too, had all kinds of disadvantages legally and religiously, but the Baptists were just notorious for being unwilling to cooperate with the government about these rules. And so when the persecution would come on, and they were badly persecuted in places like Massachusetts and Virginia, in Virginia, there were dozens of Baptist preachers being put in jail in the 1760s and 70s. Or you would have, the Baptists were holding an illicit meeting and the sheriff would show up and beat up the preacher and throw him in jail. So it was basically, they were fined for tax evasion because everyone was supposed to pay taxes to support the established church. The Baptists and some other groups said, well, we don't go to that church. Why should we pay taxes to support them? So there would be fines for tax evasion. So basically the persecution could entail virtually anything short of murdering people, basically violence, jail time, financial penalties, and anything else you can imagine.
And can you talk a little bit now about Catholicism? The British had been at war against Catholic nations for centuries. Certainly some of that feeling would have spread to the colonies. What was it like being a Catholic in the colonies?
Well, over the colonial period, you had greater and lesser seasons of persecution against Catholics, too. Catholics tended not to be as aggressive as groups like the Baptists in terms of evangelizing and civil disobedience and that sort of thing. So Catholics tended to congregate in colonies where they could expect a less persecution. Some of that was in Maryland, because in the 1630s, when Maryland was founded, it was an officially Catholic colony that had changed in the 1690s, and they became Protestant Anglican in Maryland. But still, there were a lot of descendants of the original Catholic settlers in Maryland, or they would go to places like Rhode Island or Pennsylvania or South Carolina, where they could expect less active persecution. But the Catholic Church was certainly seen as the great imperial enemy, as you suggested, of the British Empire, which was formally Protestant in terms of the Church of England was and still is today the official church in Britain. And so, especially during the 1700s, you have a series of imperial wars between Britain and either France or Spain, which were officially Catholic. And so there was a kind of hard-edged anti-Catholic sensibility in America and in Britain leading up to the eve of the Revolution. And one of the odd situations that sets up is that America desperately needs an alliance with the French to ultimately to win the Revolutionary War. America certainly would not have won the Revolutionary War if it had not struck the alliance that they did with the French in 1778, partly through Franklin's diplomacy in Paris. And so a lot of critics of the Patriot movement in the late 1770s say, oh, well, this is nice. Now you're making alliances with the despised Catholic powers in order to allegedly protect, the Protestant interest in the world. And they say, well, look, I mean, the French seem to be more friendly to liberty now than the British are. So they even say, well, maybe France is getting ready to turn Protestant. Who knows? But we'll take their military aid, regardless of what religion they are.
Very interesting overview. So we have these constellation of groups. Would you characterize any religious group as being more or less rebellious or pro-independence?
I would say that the groups that are, especially Congregationalists in New England, the established church in the New England colonies, but not in Britain, are probably the most zealous patriot religious group. And that they have a longstanding rivalry against the Anglican Church. And so they sort of meld their religious identity with their patriot identity. And so a lot of the most fire-breathing patriot sermons are coming out of places like Boston and in Connecticut and in New Hampshire and so forth.
Let me break in here. Can you quickly just describe the Congregationalist movement again, as opposed to the Anglican?
Right. So the Congregationalists are the old church of the Puritans. And so the Puritans had come largely in the 1630s to establish Massachusetts and Connecticut and New Hampshire and Maine and so forth. And so when you get to the eve of the Revolution, the Congregationalist Church is the official state church of those colonies. But as you said, they're not Anglican. They're not part of the Church of England. And so there's no natural attachment to Britain in a religious sense the way that there is for Anglican Christians in America. Now, Anglicans tend to be kind of mixed in their level of support for the Revolution. Generally in the South, Anglicans like Thomas Jefferson, like Patrick Henry, see no problem with rebelling against England, even though they're Anglicans. In the northern colonies, Anglicans, for a variety of reasons, are disproportionately likely to be loyalists, and especially Anglican leaders in places like New York City tend to be so committed to their ties to England religiously that they decide to support the crown instead of the Patriot movement. And so Anglicans nationally, I think the majority of Anglicans tend to support the Revolution, but there are some very important loyalist Anglican leaders, especially in the North, who provide some of the most articulate defenses of a Christian case of remaining loyal to the British Empire.
What was that argument?
Well, I mean, there are passages in the New Testament, in the book of Romans, in the book of 1 Peter, that seem to give pretty unequivocal directions to support the king, and that it is a Christian obligation to support the king, and that God has instituted the established authorities, both political and religious. And so whether you like them or not, and whether you agree with their policies or not, is a Christian duty to submit to the established authorities. And Romans, the book of Romans chapter 13 even threatens kind of damnation against people who revolt against the established authorities. And so it is a major disagreement between patriots and loyalists about whether those Bible passages just simply prohibit any kind of revolt against the government, or whether you pay more attention to all the instances in Scripture where God tells his people to revolt or at least resist against authority in cases like when Israel was in slavery in Egypt. Obviously, they rejected Pharaoh's authority. and revolted and ran off from slavery in Egypt to go back to Palestine and reestablish the nation of Israel. So, you know, you could either focus on the New Testament's prohibitions against or rebellion against established authority, or you could say, yeah, but I mean, that's a default principle, but there are plenty of instances in Scripture where government becomes abusive and tyrannical, and God endorses the idea of people standing up for their basic rights against tyrannical government. It's not a lockdown argument either way, but if you're going to do something like have the American Revolution, you need to have, in that culture, a biblical argument for why this is allowed or even a cause that God would bless. So the loyalists, I think the loyalist Christians have, you know, a very strong argument on their side, but the patriots have their biblical arguments too.
So to what extent then are theological arguments tipping the scale in the other arguments given to leave the British Empire and rebel? You know, you go through the long list of grievances against King George. I'm trying to think now. There are no specific, I mean, there isn't a clause in there that says, and he has instituted state churches in our colonies that we don't want, like, and that's right, a violation of our freedom. So in that respect, the text of the Declaration doesn't talk on some of these, you know, questions of taxing religions or not allowing people to evangelize.
Yeah, I think that the main one you would find in the Declaration is there's an allusion to the Quebec Act of 1774, which established Roman Catholicism under British rule in Quebec, which was utterly horrifying to the colonists. But it's described in the Declaration, I think, in more political terms. But that would probably be there are other religious issues that are provocations leading up to the revolution, but the Quebec Act, I think, in 1774 is the most obviously religious. It's also a political issue. Are we going to, in effect, let Quebec continue to be a Catholic colony or not? But that, for instance, prompts one of the very first political writings by Alexander Hamilton ever, who denounces the apparently favorable treatment of Catholicism under Quebec law when he's a college student at the future Columbia University in New York. So lots of the future patriot leaders comment on the Quebec Act as a provocation. But you're right. I mean, most of the provoking issues don't have an obviously religious component. So a lot of the religious talk, including in the Declaration, you could read as kind of obligatory references to God. And so citing the protection of divine providence, that this is just the sort of thing that you say, just to kind of guard yourself against being overly secular or something like that. But I do think that war in American history, and it's not just in the Revolution, does tend to draw out language of civil religion that usually is in Christian or at least kind of biblical phrases, if you want to cite the Hebrew Bible. And I think it's sincere. I mean, I don't think that they're being manipulative. I think somebody like Jefferson, who's drafting the Declaration, you know, when he talks about we're endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, I think he believes that. But he also knows that he's speaking to a largely religious people, so that you need to talk that way as well as a matter of you know, political wisdom. You just need to have those kind of references in there. But where religion is actually making a difference, I think the Quebec Act is one instance. But you do have occasional situations where people act against apparent self-interest for religious reasons. And I think that particularly gets my attention. For instance, you had a resistance leader in Georgia who was a Presbyterian minister named John Zubley. He was Swiss background but a Presbyterian pastor. And he was also one of the leaders of the resistance coming up to 1774, 75, he was calling for resistance against the taxes in Georgia. But when he saw the tide turning towards war and violent rebellion, Zubley told people in Georgia, he said, we are forbidden by Scripture from doing this. He said, based on Romans and other passages, we are just simply not allowed as Christians to engage in violent rebellion against the government. So I can't do that. And he basically backed out of the resistance movement when it turned to rebellion and lost everything that he had. He lost his church. He ended up hiding out in a swamp somewhere for a while and being denounced by the Patriot movement as a traitor and all this. So, I mean, you do have instances where I can't explain John Zubley's behavior other than being driven by religious conviction. But I think it's more common that, you know, you've decided that you're going to be a patriot. You've decided that you're going to be a loyalist. That may be for some religious reasons, but it's just as easily for economic or family reasons. And then you find religious ways, not in an insincere way. I think it's a convictional way, but it's not that religion is driving the decisions that they're making in the revolution. It's just that they think that their religious convictions support what they're already doing in the revolution.
Okay, so as you've been talking, Tommy, I just want to read out the passage that you've been referencing in the declaration that refers to the issue in Quebec. So this is grievance number 20 in our numbered list. For abolishing the free system of English laws in a neighboring province, Quebec, establishing therein an arbitrary government, and enlarging its boundaries so as to render it at once an example and fit instrument for introducing the same absolute rule into these colonies.
Right. So there are a number of things in the Declaration where if you just take a plain reading of it, you don't necessarily know. I mean, they don't say Quebec, but that everyone would have known reading that in 1776. That's referring to Quebec and the Quebec Act of 1774. And I think the reason maybe that they don't mention it is because they would have liked to break Quebec off to join the 13 colonies in the rebellion. That was not going to happen, but they tried. And they also don't want to make any inflammatory anti-Catholic statements in the Declaration because there are Catholics in places like Maryland who support the revolution, and people like George Washington in particular were just adamant that we can't have any just provoking displays of anti-Catholicism in the army or in the legislature because we need these people to help us, and we need the French alliance eventually to help us win the war. But there are buzzwords in that clause, an arbitrary government, and absolute rule. The phrase popery, in terms of, you know, not like the nice smelling popery, but popery as a synonym for Catholicism, the phrase popery and arbitrary government was just an absolutely standard way of talking about what Catholic rule is like, is that Catholicism goes along with absolute and arbitrary political power. So those are anti-Catholic buzzwords that people would have recognized at the time, but they pull their punch, as it were, so as to not be overtly, flagrantly anti-Catholic in that statement. And they make it more about the procedure that was used to make Catholicism and French law normative in Quebec in 1774.
Okay, so again, we're talking about some of these different religious groups, Christian groups. We just hit on the Catholics in Quebec. Quakers are a huge part of American history. Do you just want to spend a couple minutes talking about the Quakers?
Sure. I mean, the Quakers originate in England as a radical sectarian group in the mid-1600s. And they, of course, found Pennsylvania, William Penn, as a Quaker in the 1680s. But by the time you get to the Revolution, the Quakers' radical edge has really faded away. And where that becomes especially pertinent with the Revolution is that Quakers are traditionally pacifists, and so wouldn't support any war and certainly wouldn't support serving in war. But in Pennsylvania, the Quakers find ways to at least be indirectly supportive, many of them, of the Patriot movement, even if they are conscientious objectors in terms of actually serving in the Continental Army or the Pennsylvania Militia. Ben Franklin has a lot of scars from fights with the Quakers about the need to have an effective Pennsylvania militia that go back for decades before the Revolution. So there is a Pennsylvania militia in place. There are Pennsylvanians who serve in the Continental Army. There are some Quakers who sort of get around their scruples about supporting a military cause. So the Quakers don't end up being a huge problem for the American war effort. They tend to be sympathetic towards the Patriot cause, but there are still a number of Quakers who have conscientious objections to actually serving in the military.
Okay, so what you've described over the last couple of questions is this rich, diverse field of Christian beliefs that are throughout the colonies. And obviously, then persecution is an important idea. And one of the things that many of the colonies are rebelling against is the imposition of a state religion on individual colonies. I just want to read this text, which is fantastic, from Jefferson. It was written in 1779 and passed in 1786, again, in Virginia. "We, the General Assembly of Virginia, do enact that no man shall be compelled to frequent or support any religious worship, place, or ministry whatsoever, nor shall be enforced, restrained, molested, or burdened in his body or goods, nor shall otherwise suffer on account of his religious opinions or belief, but that all men shall be free to profess, and by argument to maintain, their opinions in matters of religion, and that the same shall in no wise diminish, enlarge, or affect their civil capacities." What a interesting passage. What do you think of that passage?
Well, in Virginia, you have a debate that starts in 1776 about what to do with the established church in Virginia, which is the Anglican Church. And then after the war, they begin calling it the Episcopal Church, because Church of England didn't sound so good anymore. And so, like in most of the colonies, you have a time-honored tradition of having an official state church. But now you have so much religious diversity, mostly among Christians, but you have, skeptical people like Jefferson. You have the Baptists, who are coming on very strong in Virginia and are being vigorously persecuted in Virginia in the 1760s and 70s. And so the revolution gives the defenders of religious freedom an opportunity to reevaluate whether they'll continue to have a state church during the war and after the war. Now, the Anglican Church is defunded during the war, but that's more of a wartime exigency. They're out of money for everything, and so they can't afford to keep giving tax money to the Anglican Church. And so Jefferson, as you said, writes the bill for establishing religious freedom in anticipation of fully disestablishing the Anglican Church, hopefully by the end of the war, and putting Virginia in particular on the grounds of full religious freedom. And what that means to people like Jefferson is that no church will receive tax support or special legal status anymore, and that no one will be persecuted for having allegedly, offensive or bizarre religious beliefs, whether that's somebody like Jefferson, who doesn't believe that Jesus is the Son of God, or the Baptists, who won't practice infant baptism, or just simply people who won't go to church for whatever reason, either they don't believe or they don't care to go to church, that they won't be, as the bill uses the word, molested for not complying with whatever the state's expectations are with regard to religion. So this cause unites sort of a delightfully broad range of types of people, from, I guess you would say, the left of Jefferson, who's a kind of a skeptic and you know, doesn't believe in basic Christian doctrines, to extremely strong and aggressive evangelical Christians like the Baptists, who are getting persecuted because they're way too evangelistic about Christianity. So it's a kind of a fun alliance and not one you would expect to find today at all. And so there's a debate right after the revolution about whether starting in 1783, whether you'll resume state funding for the Anglican Church or not. And the Patriot leaders in Virginia, and I would say this is true across the colonies and now at the independent states, they're about split 50-50 about whether it's a good idea to continue to have established state churches or not. Now, the First Amendment to the Constitution is going to prohibit a national established church. Congress shall make no laws respecting an establishment of religion. But that doesn't forbid the states from continuing to have established churches if they want to. And so there's a great debate in Virginia in 1784 that's basically between James Madison and Patrick Henry. Now Jefferson is going off to Paris to take Franklin's place as a diplomat in Paris, but Jefferson has left the bill for establishing religious freedom in Madison's hands and hoping that Madison will get it passed in the Virginia legislature. But Patrick Henry, who is probably the most popular politician of Virginia aside from George Washington, Patrick Henry is fairly typical as an Anglican, a committed Christian, and he wants the Anglican Church to retain some kind of established status. But even Henry realizes that, you know, the Baptists and Presbyterians and Quakers are strong in Virginia. And so he thinks that what Virginia should do is to move to a plural establishment of Christian denominations, and that what taxpayers would have to do is that they would still have to pay a tithe, a religious tax, but that they could designate the group that would receive it. And there would even be ways of, if you just simply didn't, if you didn't believe in Christianity or whatever, or, you know, Quakers didn't have paid employees at their meetings, and so you could get out of it. You have some sort of exemption if you had a legitimate case. But the state is pluralistic religiously, and so let's have some system where there's still a religious tithe, but you could designate Baptists or Presbyterians or Anglicans or whatever your commitment was. And so Madison supports Jefferson's position on this. The Baptists in particular, but some other groups, some Presbyterians, certainly the Quakers, don't want there to be any form of establishment at all. And so Madison sort of partners with those kind of dissenting Christian groups to push through the bill for establishing religious freedom. And he basically outwits Henry politically to get the bill passed, and it's adopted in 1786 and puts Virginia on a kind of surprisingly modern religious freedom footing, where basically the government just gets out of the religion business altogether and kind of establishes a sort of free market of religion, where basically the government's just not going to pay attention to religion anymore. And there won't be religious taxes, there won't be disadvantages, and the groups that just compete the hardest for adherence are going to win the day. And so the Baptists grow very quickly, Methodists come on the scene very quickly and grow quickly. And so those two groups for Protestants become the dominant Protestant groups after the Revolution. And I attribute a lot of that just to religious freedom and the willingness of those preachers to work hard to gain adherence.
And I just want to add to that, and now I'm reading from Jefferson's biography. He is very explicit that an attempt was made to add the plan of Jesus Christ, in other words, Christian language, into this bill establishing religious freedom. But he writes here in his autobiography, he's describing what groups are within the mantle of protection, so which groups are protected by this clause. And he says, within the mantle of its protection are the Jew and the Gentile, the Christian and the Mahometan, the Islamic people, the Hindu, and the infidel of every denomination. So, I mean, at least in his autobiography, he's clear that this is not something related to Christianity itself, but all religions shall be treated or be protected in the same way.
Right. It is surprising, again, that the Baptists in particular would have totally agreed with Jefferson about that. The Baptists are the group that they just simply do not want the government involved with religion because they see government religion as corrupt and persecuting. And so they say, just leave us alone. That's all we want is to be left alone, and we will do everything necessary to grow our churches and evangelize people. We just want the government to pay no attention to us. And they say, look, if that means that Islam grows at some future point in American history, fine. It's not because they believe Islam is equally good as Christianity. They just simply do not want the government involved in religion.
Good. And then you've already mentioned the Constitution, Article 6 of the Constitution. No religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. And then the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights, of course, is that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. We are at the point in this episode where I've learned so much. And we've covered so much history, and it's just been great learning from you. But I ask all my guests at the end, here we are, 250 years after the Declaration of Independence. So what do you think we should remember about the role of religion in the Declaration of Independence 250 years after the founding of the United States of America?
Well, I think it's important to remember that people who had very different views of religion and especially Christian doctrine were able to agree on the religious principles that were stated in the Declaration, or at least were not interested in opposing those principles. And I'm especially struck by all men are created equal and are endowed by their Creator with rights, that is the most powerful statement of human equality that the world has ever known. I mean, it shows up in every, you know, major independence movement in the 1800s and the 1900s. And people look to the Declaration for inspiration. And when you need to make the case for human equality, equality by creation is the most powerful idea that the world has ever seen. And so I think we live in a much more secular society, both in Europe and in America today. But I think that is still something worth considering, that the founders discovered in a created order, even someone like Jefferson, who is by no means a traditional Christian, still found in the created order the most powerful basis to argue for equal human rights. So I think that is definitely worth remembering.
Thomas S. Kidd, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, the pursuit of liberty.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americacentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americacentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americacentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americacentrum.de. Thanks for listening.